Welcome to TWiL, The Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on May 18th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore.
And today we're joined by Kristen Madison. Kristen is professor of law and health sciences at Northeastern University School of Law. She's a very well-known commentator on sort of the shifts in data and information in the healthcare space. In particular, her research has illuminated the potential movement from traditional market-displacing regulation to more market-oriented regulatory approaches. Really glad that you're with us today, Kristen.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be talking with you.
It's a... I don't know, Frank, maybe half a dozen shows ago, we dipped our toes into the thorny world of wellness programs. And I think at that time, we sort of concentrated on sort of the EEOC pieces and the what was then the relatively new but certainly controversial action brought by EEOC against Honeywell. And some of the sort of the pushback that was appearing from sort of business circles. Since then, we've had a veritable barrage of regulatory issuances and guidances from various federal agencies. We're also, I think, being helped in understanding what's going on by a very good piece from Tim Jost in the Health Affairs blog. For me, the regulatory complications are still too great to get my feeble mind around. So I know Frank and I were both delighted to see, Kristen, your piece in Health Affairs, where you clearly explain everything. So why don't you you help me out and our listeners by telling us sort of where we are with the regulatory spaghetti and wellness programs?
It is a very tall pile of spaghetti. So you know, maybe my piece sounded more clear than I actually think things are. But there's a lot going on in this area with respect to wellness programs. So I think your previous discussion placed at a time where the EEOC had filed suit against Honeywell challenging its wellness program, and in particular the way that it used incentives within this program. And that happened last fall. The immediate aftermath of that suit was a lot of protest, particularly from large employers, about the way that the EEOC had intervened. From those employers' perspective, the Affordable Care Act had reaffirmed the federal commitment to supporting wellness programs going forward. So at the time that HIPAA was passed in 1996, they had said that health plans, the group health plans, couldn't discriminate against people based on health status, but there was this exception for wellness programs or programs of health promotion. And in 2006, regulations laid out what those programs could look like. And those regulations were reinforced by the Affordable Care Act. And in addition, the Affordable Care Act went further in making it a little bit easier to implement those programs by raising the amount of money that could be attached to wellness incentives. So instead of attaching 20% of a $6,000 policy to something like body mass index, now 30% could be attached to body mass index. And there were a lot of other ways that the ACA supported wellness programs. And so from an employer's perspective, there was a lot of reason to move forward with these programs, but there still was a lot of uncertainty about how other laws like the Americans with Disabilities Act applied to the programs. And then they waited for guidance. They asked for formal guidance, but none was forthcoming, and then they got the suit. At least this was how the employers saw it. And so at that point, there was a lot of conversation about what should be done and increased calls for EEOC regulation. And after your conversation with the earlier commenter, the proposed regulations were actually issued. And so people who criticized these programs, many of them were hoping that what they would say is that you could not embark on a program that asked disability-related question or included a medical examination if you tied incentives to that, because tying money to asking those questions would render the program involuntary, and involuntary questions were prohibited under the ADA. But what EEOC actually said in their proposed regulations was that you could tie incentives to these questions, and the way that they did that was to extend the 30% ceiling that existed previously under the EACA to questions involving disability-related inquiries or medical examinations. In other words, the old rules were applicable to health contingent programs like body mass index or cholesterol. So hitting a particular body mass index, you could get extra reward or suffer a penalty because of that. And now, under the EEOC rules, that limit would also apply to the questionnaire that you took in order to get involved in that program. And so if an employer said, if you answer this disability-related question, we'll give you $1,000, that number is also included within that 30% ceiling. And so I think a lot of people would appreciate the clarity of this rule. I think employers are going to be looking for more clarity, and disability advocates will be very concerned about the ability to put these incentives on the line.
So one of the questions that I had in reading your posting on Health Affairs and in thinking about the ongoing involvement of EEOC and other agencies here is, if we could just make a little more concrete for listeners some of the financial stakes here. I noted, I believe it was in your posting, that if there's tobacco cessation programs could actually lead to a 50% discount. So would that essentially be the upshot of that sort of a wellness program would be that the cost for health insurance for those using tobacco could be twice as much as that for those not using tobacco? Did I read that correctly?
So under the old rules, under the Affordable Care Act rules, up to 50% of the cost of employee-only insurance. So if you have a $6,000 employee-only insurance plan, which is about average, up to $3,000 could be tied to actually quitting smoking or not smoking at all. And so that was the old rule. And so this is a different rule. And one of the interesting things about this rule is this rule doesn't actually apply to that kind of program if that program doesn't involve any disability-related questions or medical examinations. The part where things get interesting is that a number of employers have gone to biometric exams as a way of testing for whether you really did quit smoking or whether you really are a non-smoker, not just asking you whether you are, but actually physically testing. And once you physically test, then you're in the ADA world. And then the 30% limitation is going to apply. So the 50% that was true under the ACA is also true under the ACA individual insurance regulations, where they disallowed setting premiums on the basis of health factors, but there's an exception there for smoking status. There are a lot of ways that smoking status is disfavored under the ACA. And so the ADA proposed regulations would further constrict some of those incentives, but otherwise would continue to allow the 50% to function for things that are outside of the scope of the ADA, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Although with the two different limits applying to essentially similar facts, you can understand why you indeed have been calling for still more clarity may be required.
Right. So, it's very strange, but I mean, if the focus is on invasive exams, if that's really the core of the current concern, then it's true that a biometric exam is more invasive than asking questions. I think really the issue is what objective are you trying to achieve through the ADA and its regulations?
So also in your post, you talked about the EEOC sort of asking in the proposed rule as to whether it should tie limits to insurance affordability. Can you hum us a few bars on that as to how that would work?
Well, that's a really great question, how that would work. So here's the issue. When the ACA put in place limits, it chose this number 20% originally and then 30%, in part on the basis of the idea of what's too big a number. What number is so big that it basically renders insurance unaffordable, undermining the whole goal of HIPAA initially and the ACA today? When we go into the ADA world, the question is actually distinct. The question is, how big can an incentive be before it renders a program involuntary? And so maybe it's okay to say that the same 30% limit should apply, but maybe that's not okay. And it's particularly not okay for people who are low income when you're starting to talk about tying $1,800, say, to answering a particular question. For many people, that might feel involuntary. And so the idea that they seem to be playing with in the preamble to the proposed regulation is whether it might be possible to, instead of putting a single ceiling, saying, well, let's look at our affordability rules that exist for different purposes under the ACA and tie the quantity of incentives to those. So we can have an incentive program, but to the extent that implementing those incentives would make insurance unaffordable under the ACA rules, that kind of incentive would not be permissible. Now, I think it's really interesting, and there's a lot of theoretical appeal to that. The issue would be one of implementation on an individual specific level, how exactly that would work, and whether people would perceive that as problematic if they're facing a different incentive structure than, you know, someone down the road who might have a different household income, even though they're in the same employer in the same position. And I think that would be a little bit strange to work with, but it's something that the EOC is interested in exploring.
Well, thank you so much, Kristen, for that really detailed and precise rundown about some of the most complex regulatory interchanges between these EEOC, HHS, other entities, the White House. I think all have a stake here. And I also really appreciate your post, and I'll be putting it up on our show notes page because it points out the role of large corporations in advocating for wellness programs. They appear to be really big fans of these health initiatives. Well, now I'd like to actually transition us to a second topic, also drawing on your expertise, Kristen, which is news this week about the reported by Modern Healthcare and The Hill on an updated draft of the 21st Century Cures Act, which is an act that has been bouncing around in the House of Representatives and is essentially an effort to update interoperability provisions and to deal with the perceived growing problem of EHR vendor software not being able to talk to one another and impeding health information exchange. And we thought you'd be a terrific person to interview on this, Kristen, because of your 2014 North Carolina Law Review article on health regulators as data stewards and your prior work on health rankings and ratings in other areas, because you're one of the few people who have not only done in-depth analysis of the nature of health data creation, collection, aggregation, facilitation at the federal level, but you've also asked the critical question, does it matter? Does it actually have an impact? And so I was wondering if we could just start with your take on the need for updating or improving interoperability provisions in the law, and then maybe we could move on to think about where it might make a big impact.
I do think that interoperability is going to be critically important going forward. And so in my data stewards piece, a lot of that is just about the facilitating role that the federal government can play in creating databases or at least data structures that could be used to aggregate information in ways that will permit all sorts of analysis. And maybe we could get into some of that later, but internal analysis by healthcare providers or public health experts, many different people could usefully use this information to answer really important questions. The problem has been figuring out ways to draw all this information together when it's held in different silos. And so my understanding of the problem is that, you know, part of it is technical, right, and how this information is collected and stored within organizations, and the fact that the standards that are being used or the mechanisms that are being used aren't necessarily compatible. And part of this might also be about business practices and the desire to keep information inside a particular kind of electronic health record. And certainly it's been a very slow process and a very frustrating process in trying to get data out to people.
Yes, I think that is that complementary problem of both the business practices sometimes leading entities to want to lock up their data or think of that as their proprietary advantage versus the public health or quality improvement imperative of getting together as much data as possible. That is a real tension. My larger question is that, you know, here you gave this great overview of all of the problems that could result in health data stewardship. What do you think are the largest problems now? And do you see any positive initiatives on the horizon to address them, or do you think they'll remain pretty intractable?
Well, I think at some level they'll always be intractable. It's just too complicated an area for there not to be some sort of hurdles. But I think it's a matter of two steps forward, one step back. So we've seen a lot of initiatives over the last 5 to 10 years to make data more available to people. And that includes various provisions, making data claims more available, like Medicare claims more available for people to analyze, including a court case that allowed more data to be accessed. And also the High Tech Act and all the money it put toward adopting electronic health records, I mean, I think it'll have a tremendous impact on making this data more usable and available. And then we see, you know, blocks, information blockages and backpedaling. So just interoperability challenges have been a big deal. Or recently, there was a case, I think CERT is still pending before the Supreme Court, there was a case where a health plan, a self-funded health plan, challenged a state law that required the release of their claims data. And many states are interested in collecting data from all their employers, including self-funded employers. And this was an ERISA challenge that was brought to block this rule. And so if that were recognized broadly as the rule, that could really limit data aggregation efforts. So I think it really is a long process. The question of, you know, whether we can make full use of this data to really improve care, that's a separate and even more challenging question.
Just to fill in a little detail on sort of the interoperability piece, and really, actually, there are two aspects to this. There is pure interoperability, which is, if you like, the interoperability between healthcare providers, insurers, and so on. And then there is a sort of patient empowerment and access to data. Meaningful Use 3 does quite a lot with regard to the latter, moving away from just the old sort of download model to actually having proposing open APIs to achieve that. If you look at the interoperability space, and I think we've all written on this to an extent, I in particular have referred to it consistently as the interoperability fail of meaningful use. As interoperability has sort of crumbled, attention has started to turn from not just looking at the technical aspects, but actually looking at the behaviors of some of the market participants. And so we started back last year with an FTC workshop on competition in healthcare, which sort of first raised the idea of what's called information blocking. Then you all know we had the Cromnimus bill right at the end of 2014 that told ONC to do a report on this, which they dutifully did. Meanwhile, ONC itself has been dealing with a proposed interoperability port. We've had some tweaks in that the DocFix bill has an impact on meaningful use and some of the requirements, moving to a more of a value-based model. And now, just when we thought it couldn't get any more complicated, there are 40 pages in the Cures Act that deal with this. And there are a couple of different issues here. The first one, which I think is the headline-grabbing one, is information blocking. And Section 30.3010A F, now we will have a statutory definition, if the Senate will buy this bill, a statutory definition of information blocking and various sort of decertification and penalties and all sorts of nasty things will be imposed on providers by OIG and FTC with a bit of ONC help if they're bad. But I think the more interesting question is how in the future are we going to improve interoperability? And there are a couple of different ways to do this. We've concentrated from meaningful use so far with essentially looking at the participants, saying you must have interoperability. You must use interoperability, that's meaningful use, and you must use interoperable technologies, that's certification. And I think more and more, at least I am turning around to wondering whether that's the right approach, and that instead of looking at the participants, we should be looking more at the data. And I think probably one of the most interesting parts of this story at the moment, and I'm happy to report clearly the most nerdy, is FHIR, which is F-H-I-R, but pronounced FHIR, which is the Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources bundle of tech, which is an HL7 initiative. And basically, this promises to be, quote, the HTML of healthcare. And instead of sort of having a document-centric approach, which is kind of what we have, I mean, you know, to really make it, to oversimplify it, our current EHRs sort of push out a Word document, in quotes, and then the next EHR only reads Word perfect. So it has to kind of translate the document into a different format, and it doesn't go very well at the moment. FHIR looks at data elements and uses a sort of a common data style, which is basically an XML variant, which gives you a lot more flexibility. So I'm wondering whether we've actually been going up the wrong creek for the last 5 years, and we're going to have to wait for this to shake out. And here's the sort of the question thrown back at you, Kristen. How many of the problems are we suffering in this space at the moment because of a lack of data liquidity? And how much is it because we're not entirely clear what we want to do with the data or how the data can change the way the healthcare system is operating?
I think that's right. I don't think we are entirely clear about how we want to use the data. It's funny, I mean, I've heard a lot of discussions about the promise of different kinds of information exchanges, but simultaneously, I hear all this discussion of, well, what are the use cases? How are we going to use this? And it seems like it really ought to be obvious, but actually it's not. One of the things that I wonder a lot about is the role of patients in this. I know meaningful use has put some pressure on providers or to really start to engage patients, but it doesn't seem like that's happening or happening as much as people hoped it would. And it seems that I wonder if we focus more on patients, whether that would have any impact at all in sort of redefining what kinds of information we make available and in what ways and how it ought to be transferred.
I do think that is a great question to be asking. And, you know, it's something because what Nick just brought up reminds me of the ongoing snafu in terms of the ICD-9, ICD-10 transition, and how now there's pressure to just skip ICD-10 and go to ICD-11. And perhaps that's all going to be a prelude to a promotion of, say, forms of information capture that are much more complex and much more comprehensive than what we have presently. And I also think that the key questions become exactly what you're saying, Kristen. What are these use cases, and how are we going to be able to optimize the information collection, dissemination, organization in ways that are going to be advancing the highest value uses and use cases. Unless there's more from you or from Nick, I just was thinking if we might move on to our next topic, which I wanted to focus us in on the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, in terms of trade law. And I know that in health law, it's already complex enough, given the overlay of contract and tort, and then state and federal statutes, and all the regulatory apparatus, multiple agencies involved. And I just wanted to add to that mix one more, which is now the international dimension, the importance of international intellectual property and trade law, which came up twice in the news this week. The first was in pushing forward opposition to the upcoming TPP or to votes on fast-track authority for the president in terms of implementing it or getting it approved. The Doctors Without Borders has raised grave concerns about the trade agreement essentially reducing access to medicines because it would grant pharmaceutical companies additional patents for changes to existing medicines even when the changes provide no therapeutic benefit, and worries that it would lock in high and unsustainable drug prices due to a lack of availability of affordable generics. So you get a lot of pressure from NGOs in that area. And I think it brings up a larger question of health economics as well, because the pushback from pharma is a statement that essentially many of the countries involved do have relatively high GDPs compared to around the world. And there's a press by pharma to get them to pay what pharma believes is their fair share for drugs. It reminds me of an old Richard Epstein debate at University of Chicago, where Epstein actually debated himself on whether the globe should be paying more for drugs or whether the U.S. should continue to be bearing a lot of the weight of pharmaceutical innovation and its costs. The other aspect of health economics that came up with the TPP this week was concern that essentially in order to pay for something called trade adjustment assistance, TPP as a bipartisan initiative would lead to a shaving away of certain cost increases in Medicare. And of course, this is all sort of a budget trickery on one level, but the larger concern that I think it raised was a lot of advocacy groups were saying that this is a prelude toward Medicare becoming a bit of a piggy bank for any initiative that comes up. So if the Congress needs money to spend, it will just sort of make stealth or not so stealth adjustments to expected or anticipated increases in Medicare spending, or mandate some sort of down the road, kick the can type of cuts to Medicare. So I thought that each of these areas in terms of the TPP was raising broader issues of global health, access to drugs, and also the role of Medicare in budgeting. And
so, Frank, you've dived a lot deeper into this than I have, but is the sense that the intellectual property tweaks are going to raise drug prices globally only in underdeveloped countries or also in the U.S.?
That is a terrific question. And I believe that the concern is not so much in the U.S. It's more of a concern about imposition of certain trade rules that may restrict the degrees of freedom that other parties to the TPP would have in implementing their own healthcare system. I remember that, you know, a few years ago, I believe South Korea was complaining that essentially some of their methods for reducing reducing the size of the number of medications that were available for certain conditions was attacked as a potential infringement of global trade laws, that this was sort of a national law that was running up against the free flow of pharmaceuticals to the different nations. I think Australia has raised similar concerns. The other part of TPP that may impinge here on countries' freedom to implement their own laws would be the investor-state dispute settlement mechanism, which essentially allows investors in various countries to go to arbitral quasi-judicial entities, which would essentially be able to stop countries from implementing changes to laws that dramatically varied the rate of return or the ability of a corporation to recoup on its investment. So a worry there might be, if you think back to the big concerns about anthrax, even in the U.S., I think, what was that, 6-7 years ago, there was a threat to essentially reduce the price of Cipro by half or something like that as an emergency measure. And I would expect that were TPP to go forward and this ISDS dispute settlement provision to also go forward, that any effort to do something like that would be subject to challenge by the patent holder. So that's another way in which I think in general, it's right now the concern is about the degree of flexibility of the healthcare provisioning and payment and financing schemes of all of the party states and ones outside of the U.S. But if you think to that example in the ISDS, then there's possibly some real impact on the degrees of freedom of the U.S. policymaking as well.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Kristen Madison for joining us. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you.
We post our show notes at twill.com. That's TWIHL.com. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry. That's NicolasTerry on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be found?
I'm Frank Pasquale and can be found at HealthPI on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us and have a legally interesting but healthy week.